Llegaron los Propane Days a Lowe's. Desde ahora hasta el 16 de junio, los miembros MVPs de Lowe's reciben un 20% de reembolso en pintura con una tarjeta de regalo electrónica de Lowe's por compras de pinturas elegibles de $100 o más. Lleva la nueva y exclusiva pintura HGTV Home de Sherwin-Williams SpecRite para interiores. Lowe's sabe de pros. Aplican exclusiones, restricciones y más términos. Visita Lowe's.com/L/Pro Loyalty Terms. Sujeto a cambios.
Should the Steelers take a defensive lineman or sign one in free agency? Or both? The Steelers defensive line has been a source of pride for Steelers fans for years, especially with Cam Hayward playing. But Cam Hayward is getting up there, and the question is going to be, what do they do to find a partner next to him or even find the next version of him? We'll talk about that in just a minute here on the North Shore Drive podcast, as well as the success of Pitt Hoops. Should they be ranked? And what's gotten into the Penguins? Can they get into the second half of the season on a strong note after beating the Sharks? We'll talk about all that right here in the North Shore Drive podcast from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. I'm your host, Chris Carter. Let's get into it. You are now listening to the North Shore Drive podcast, a show on all things Pittsburgh sports from the writers of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, hosted by Christopher Carter. Hello and welcome to the North Shore Drive podcast from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. I'm your host, Chris Carter. We talk all things sports Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I thank you to my friends Brian Batko and Noah Hiles for holding it down on the days that I was on vacation. But I'm back, and I'm back here with Ray Fittipaldo joining us, our legendary Steelers beat writer here. Ray, it's good to see your face. Good to talk to you again, my friend. We already went over Your first mock draft. We've talked about it on this show, and your pick of Lucas Van Ness as a defensive line prospect. But I wanted to talk to you more about this defensive line class, because Cam Hayward is the unquestioned leader of the Steelers. He's the guy who carried the Franco Harris flag out. He's been the guy there for over a decade now, and it's kind of been a given that Cam Hayward's going to do what Cam Hayward does in the middle of the defense. But the Steelers, in my opinion, need to find the next version of him soon. They can keep finding partners like they did with Larry Ogunjobi in free agency, but I think that they need to start finding the young guys, not just veterans to plug in there, but the young guys to fit in there. If you're the Steelers right now, and obviously you pick them picking a defensive lineman, even if Lucas Van Ness or, like, you know, the guys in the first round aren't necessarily your best picks, is this a class where you're comfortable still finding that guy with either the second round picks or even the third round pick?
It's a fairly deep class, but it's not like the defensive backs this year or the tight ends this year. So that's, I mean, honestly, Chris, that's one of the reasons that I had the Steelers taking Van Ness at number 17. That was because it's a fairly shallow class. Plus, you got a lot of depth with the corners, and I think you can probably get your corners in round two, much more so than you can maybe get, a defensive lineman. But listen, there are guys who might be there at 32 or even 49. A guy like Clemson's Brian Brassi, he's all over the place on these draft boards and these top 50 lists. Some people have him in the top 10. Some people have him down near 40 or 45. So
that's crazy.
He's a really interesting guy. I think his injury history is playing into that a little bit. I think that's one of the reasons why he could slide a little bit into the mid to late first round, maybe even early second round. But when you watch him on tape, he's really, really good. The only question is, doesn't have a long resume, right? You know, kind of had some injuries happen to Clemson, some personal issues that maybe affected him. And he's one of those guys that you would definitely be taking on potential. He's really good on tape, but there's just a limited amount of tape that's out there on him because of his injuries.
I hear you on that. And when you look at guys like that, it's like, okay, there's guys like this. But then there's also guys like Kalijah Kansi, the pit man who's going to be at the NFL scouting combine, he's 6 foot tall, which is a little undersized. If you want, the big mauler type of defensive lineman, like we said, how Cam Hayward is at 6'5" and huge and how he is able to move people. But, you know, he's electric. He's able to get around guys. He showed that his size wasn't an issue in the ACC, much like how Aaron Donald showed his size wasn't an issue. Granted, Aaron Donald was a different kind of defensive force for the Panthers back when he played for them. But still, are there guys that are after that first class of, you know, the Jalen Carters and the Brzees that you're looking at that could be like, you know what? You know, even if Brzee doesn't fall that far, there's still going to be guys that if you get him in the second round that you're like, hey, he can be a cornerstone piece for the defensive line.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple guys like that. You're probably thinking Miles Murphy is one of those top-tier guys, right?
Could be, yes.
Yeah, so how about Keon White? I don't know if he's
– I like Keon White, yeah.
Yeah, so meet Keon White. He might be cracking that top tier. If you're looking at purely guys, day two picks, how about a Keanu Benton from Wisconsin, a guy who flashed a little bit at the Senior Bowl?
Mm-hmm.
He's a good prospect. How about now? If you're looking, I don't know if I would be a fan of this, but Andy Weidel had a similar pick last year when mm-hmm. he picked Jordan Davis. How about Siaki Ika from Baylor?
Huge guy.
He would be. You wouldn't have any issues with that run. If that run defense was top 10 mm-hmm. Last season, Chris, you put him in there. I'd be shocked if they weren't top five. You know, playing him, putting him in the middle of that defense. And he'd be the replacement for, you know, Montrevious Adams / Tyson Alulu. Now, the only thing about Ika is there's not really a lot of versatility there. You know,
right.
Pass rush, he's not going to rush the passer. And, you know, I worry about that a little bit. I watched the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way Mahomes was able to move around the pocket, run a little bit when he had to. The Eagles had 70 sacks during the regular season. They were a dominant front throughout the season, and the Chiefs did a good job on them. And you know, when a guy like Mahomes had to run, he was able to run on them. So, I would just be a little bit concerned about a guy like Ika and how much you could afford to play him. Right, so I wouldn't take him at 32. I don't even know if I'd take him at 49, Chris, but if you can get like third round value on a guy like him, I would not have an issue at all, you know, plugging him in, say 30 snaps a game, you know, 30 to 40% of the snaps each game, play him in running situations, and he'd be a horse for you. I just worry a little bit about the versatility.
No, I agree with that because that's the interesting challenge, right, that you face with getting defensive linemen. A lot of guys are pass rush specialists. A lot of guys are run stuffing specialists, but very few are both. And, like, you know, Cam Hayward's one of the examples. He can do both. But you saw that work against the Eagles in this past game. You know, one, their pass rush never sacked Patrick Mahomes. Like you said, he was truly elusive even with the high ankle sprain that he was dealing with. But on top of that, you know, you had, you know, the fact that the Chiefs ran the ball on them. Several of their running backs were averaging over 4 or 5 yards per carry, and they were able to kind of do what they wanted. And that was the weakness, that if you could poke one weakness out of the Eagles roster, it was their inability to consistently stop the run throughout right. the season. And that's something, yes, the Steelers fixed this past year, but can they fix it again? It's going to be, you know, can they improve upon it or hold it where it's at? You know, there's questions about Larry Ogunjobi. I want to ask you this, Ray. If you're the Steelers, Javon Hargrave's set to be a free agent. Is he, you know, a lot of Steelers fans want them to go out and get him. I just don't know if Javon Hargrave is going to be able to be gotten for a reasonable price considering the other needs that they have, because he was like a $13+ million hit on the Eagles this past year. He still costed them about $11 million in dead money this year. So he's going to be looking for a big contract coming off a year where he had 11 sacks. So I don't know if he's the answer, if drafting a guy and then re-signing Ogunjobi or getting another, you know, solid veterans, there's the answer. But is Hargrave something that you have an eye on right now?
Not me, Chris. I mean, listen, Javon Hargrave, he grew up here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about professionally. He got his start here. But he's going to turn 30. And he was an older draft pick when the Steelers got him in the third round back in 2016. And I don't know if you could pour those types of free agent money resources into a guy who, you know, could be getting close to the end of his prime. So, you know, I heard reports earlier that he's looking for maybe $20 million a year. I mean, how many guys like that can you have on your roster, right? I mean, TJ Watt making $30 million a year. You know, Minka's making he's one of the top highest paid safeties. You got Cam Hayward. Mm-hmm. There's only so many defenders like that you could have on your roster. So I, you know, if it's me, Chris, I definitely draft a guy early with one of those first three picks. A guy like you said, who can be your next Cam Hayward, hopefully. And then I also try to re-sign Larry Ogunjobi or someone else who can come in and be a starter just in case that new draft pick, you know, isn't ready to assume that role as a rookie. So, you know, they know Ogunjobi. They know what they have in him. If they can get him on another one-year, $10 million deal, something like that, I would do that in a heartbeat. But you definitely draft a young guy to develop behind those two.
I hear you on that. We'll have a lot more coverage on the NFL draft coming all throughout the offseason. Stay tuned with us. Ray, thanks so much for joining us. We got to switch topics because I was at the Pitt basketball game last night, and they dominated Boston College. I'll talk about that with my partner in crime, Noah Hiles, talking on the Pitt Beat in just a minute here on the North Shore Drive podcast. So don't go anywhere. But first, we got to talk to you guys about our sponsors at Valley Pool and Spa. Wouldn't it be nice if, while the weather's nice right now, you know that cold's coming back? Best place to be when that's happening is in your own hot tub, swim, spa, or sauna installed right in your home. The only place to get that is Valley Pool and Spa. You can relax and soak in your hot tub or swim spa for Valley Pool and Spa before the snow comes back. And you can refresh and rejuvenate in one of their Finlayo saunas. It's going to help you de-stress, feel renewed, and get back out ready to tackle your day at any point in time. Go to Valley Pool and Spa right now and save big on all their in-stock hot tubs, swim spas, and spa and saunas by going to valleypoolspa.com. That's valleypoolspa.com. Back here on the North Shore Drive podcast, I'm your host, Chris Carter. We switch topics from the Steelers with Ray Fittipaldo to my partner, Noah Hiles, as we both cover the Pitt Athletics beat in the city. Noah, we were at a butt-whooping last night where Pitt just gave it to Boston College, both on the scoreboard and physically. And Boston College being a physical team, they definitely, it looked like, and we talked about this, they got under the skin of guys, a guy like Quentin Post, who's, you know, had one of the highest field goal percentages in the conference for how well he shoots the ball. And I think it was another example of how this Pitt team can mold itself to beat various opponents. There's not one way to win for the Panthers. They can find several different ways to beat you, and that's why I think they've become such a dangerous team late in the season.
Yeah, I mean, there's just not one superstar on this team. This team has every game you see 3 to 4 players play probably an above average performance of what they're typically capable of doing. And it's just which 3 or 4 of those guys is it going to be on certain nights? I mean, some nights it's JV and Blake Hinson. Other times it's Nike Sabande off the bench, or, you know, the Twins even having big games. But I mean, Nelly Cummings was fantastic last evening, as I wrote about. I think that he was kind of the guy that provided that spark for Pitt when it was losing 16-10 early on. The Panthers go on a 15-2 run to really take the lead, never really let it go. I mean, Nelly got the job going, or got things going offensively, just with a couple of nice mid-range jump shots. And then with his assists, he finished tying his season high with 8. And they were all big, a lot of them on three-pointers. And then a guy that we've been talking a lot about, and he actually might be the most responsible for why Pitt has gone from winning a lot of close games to now being able to blow opponents out, and that's Fetty Federico. His impact on the defensive end is seismic. It is really impressive to see where he's come. And his first game at Pitt against UT Martin, he was the subject of my game story. I thought he played really well. But he's gone from a guy where it's, okay, he could be a little bit of a talent here in a couple years, to he's probably one of the best defensive players in the ACC this season, just especially in the front court. The way he protects a rim, the way he can, you know, deal with teams that like to switch on screens and everything, the way he can run the floor in transition, all of it. He is a really impressive player, and he's been playing some great basketball in the month of February.
Yeah, he certainly has. That's why I wrote about him in my good, bad, and ugly. I've written about him in pretty much all my good, bad, and uglies, because it's been a theme. The bad is always whoever has to go up and shoot against Fetty Federico, because he is going to block your shot. And shout out to Dave Damashek. Federico. I got to say the whole name when I talk about it. Damashek's going to come after me. But point being about Fetty, and Blake Hinson talked about this. When he's playing like that, when he takes away the five of the other team, and he's able to take away the paint, the rest of them can just play defense. They can just go out and say, you know what? We don't have to jump down and help. And sometimes they do. Like sometimes if they can get a trap, like how they got Armando Bacot to travel on that late possession that gave them a chance to win the game at North Carolina, like you still do that, but you don't have to. Whereas like early in the year, even when Fetty was playing well, there was a concern that like, hey, get down there and help him before the other team's bigs just take this game over. Now it's not only is it not a concern, it's a resource that you have. As the Pitt Panthers, it's something that they're able to count on every game now, and it's not just the average run of the mill five that's just being rolled out there by a bad team like by Louisville. Armando Bacot had problems with Fetty. Quinn Post, one of the best scorers, Quinn Post all season long, I said he shot 57%. His lowest shooting percentage in a game was 44%. He shot 22% last night against Pitt, and that just shows what they're doing. But away from this game, the topic that every Pitt fan wants to know about is why aren't they ranked? And I think there's a lot that you and I have talked about this. There's a lot of the pedigree that comes into the opinions of voters. We found out that about 20 people voted them to be ranked this year out of 60 plus voters or whoever does the AP voting for basketball. But I look at that, and then I look at the KenPom and the net rankings that everyone uses. And it's like, I don't know where Pitt, Pitt doesn't seem to care. Like Jeff Capel said, like, we don't look at that. And they've done a very good job ignoring that element, in conversations or when they hit the podium. But it's tough to ignore how Pitt has played so well. They have the second best road record against Power Five opponents, only to Alabama, one of the best teams in the country. And they're playing very well. They're number one in the ACC right now. And the net rankings have them at 49. The KenPom rankings have them at, one second, I have to go find it again because it's so far down, at 55.
Yeah.
And it's just like, are we serious? It'd be one thing if there was a bunch of teams ahead of them that were just clearly better and just having better seasons and didn't have slow starts. But like Northwestern, who Pitt stomped on, is ahead of them. North Carolina, who's in the same conference as Pitt, has a lesser record than they do overall, a lesser conference record, and has been swept by the Panthers, is higher than them in both KenPom and net rankings. That's when I look at them and say, these formulas are wrong. These aren't good metrics if you're putting teams like that ahead of these other teams.
Yeah, I think it comes down to Pitt started really low in something like KenPom. Net, I don't know what the criteria is for net. But with KenPom, I think Pitt started close to like 100 on the year, right? So it's starting far back. And then when you consider how the Panthers started their season, they started 1-3. They're only going further down. And then when those teams they lose to, West Virginia, Michigan, VCU, and then you add in a Vanderbilt loss in December, it just makes their climb a lot more difficult, climb out of that. And when you have a lot of teams in the ACC underperforming as far as program standards go, the conference as a whole carries less value for each win. They're going to say, okay, well, Pitt beat three ranked teams, but they were all home wins. And one of those ranked teams, North Carolina, is on the bubble right now. So I think the metrics just really, it's just an unfavorable thing for Pitt because of the ACC. Wins against Louisville, wins against Florida State, they don't mean anything this year, right? The Boston College win doesn't mean anything. Like that essentially, Boston College, I don't even going to waste my time looking up what they're at KenPom. It's probably the equivalent of beating like a bottom tier Atlantic 10 team this year as far as the KenPom rankings go. Things like that. And that's where Pitt gets hurt. If Pitt's in a better conference as far as what these net rankings or KenPom ratings determine is a better conference, it allows for its losses to look a lot more acceptable and its wins to look a lot more impressive. And that's why you see a team like Creighton getting the love it is, because the Big East is highly regarded this season. It's why you see teams like Texas Tech, who are almost, I think, in last place in the Big 12, are still able to get this notoriety because everyone in the Big 12 is viewed as a possible tournament team right now. I don't think the ACC is that bad personally. I think we're going to see something like we saw last year, where there's going to be an 8 or a 9 seed from the ACC that was hardly, and I'm not just referring to Pitt. It could be NC State. It could be maybe Syracuse, who's coming on right now. Could be North Carolina or Duke, whoever. One of those teams, I think, could go on a run. And it's because it's super talented and the league is just undervalued. And I don't know. But I do think what we're seeing here with Pitt is a very interesting kind of case study of how these rankings don't really evaluate things properly in the era of basketball that we're in, where they have to allow room for error for new teams. Yeah. In today's world of college basketball, half the teams, if not more, are going to be completely new rosters year in and year out. I mean, Pitt might be an exception next year where they don't have a ton of turnover, but a lot of teams are going to, you know, use that portal and bring in a couple high schoolers, and you're going to have eight or nine new guys every single year. And you can't penalize a team all season long for needing a few games to find its footing. Granted, it should be held accountable for some losses. Vanderbilt is an inexcusable loss. They should not have lost that game. And getting blown out the way they did to West Virginia and Michigan is ugly. But still, I mean, my goodness. It's just, if you can't logically look at teams like Ohio State or, you know, North Texas or whoever is ahead of Pitt in some of these metrics and see how the Panthers are just a better basketball team, then that's on you at this point.
No, I feel you, and I think that that's where I'm at with a lot of these teams. And also, I mean, I think part of this, and this has been something that's been brought up, I think part of this whole their schedule isn't as strong is the perception of the ACC and just the, oh, they're just not as good this year. When it's like, well, no, I think the ACC is good. They just aren't the team that you're used to being good. It's not Duke and North Carolina just running the table all year. It's top five seeds all season long. But Miami's a good basketball team. Virginia's a very good basketball team. And those teams are going to be rocking. And heck, I think you can even look back to last year. Three of the Elite Eight teams were ACC teams. Miami got there, lost to the eventual champion Kansas. Duke and North Carolina played each other in the Final Four. Like, it's I don't know how you look at this at the conference and be like, oh yeah, they're just not as good. You know, I get there's metrics. I get that there's other numbers behind this stuff, but I just have this feeling that we're going to get to the Elite Eight this year, and there's going to be more ACC teams than Big Ten teams, and you know there's gonna be we're gonna be looking at that, and then it's gonna start all over again next year, where ACC teams might be devalued in the ranking process, and because of the perception of their conference, because the top dogs that we've always understood to be the top dogs aren't there anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't label a conference's overall ability on non-conference play games that take place in November and December. I mean, those teams. North Carolina, for example, started the year ranked number one in the country. And when it was winning or losing games in November and December, that team was viewed completely differently than what it is now. And I still think the Tar Heels are still probably have one of the more talented starting fives that are out there. But, you know, their wins or losses, if you're going to reward a team for beating number one North Carolina in November, I don't get how you can penalize that conference for having that. I just don't get it. Like, those games should have less meaning, is I guess what I'm trying to get at. It's really weird, and I think it de-incentivizes teams to make these compelling non-conference matchups in November and December now, because if your conference just gets dominated by the SEC or the Big Ten or the Big 12 or whatever, if you just have a down week or month where all of your guys just aren't able to get the job done, you run the risk of having good teams in your league not making the tournament.
Yeah, I think it's certainly questions that are going to continue to be answered. Pitt plays Virginia Tech this Saturday. We'll be on hand there, checking out the game and seeing the action there. And you can get all of that at the post-gazette.com. But don't go away just yet. We still got to talk about the Penguins. They had a big win over San Jose. And I know that's not saying a lot considering San Jose's record, but This is a Penguins team that needs to be able to rebound into the second half of the season. We'll talk about that in Casey DeSmith's night with Andrew Destin in a minute here on the North Shore Drive podcast. But first, we got to talk to you guys about Yinz's in the Berg. Yinz's in the Berg is the number one place to get all your Pittsburgh sports apparel, accessories, and much, much more. Go to Yinz's in the Berg. They have two stores in the Strip District that you can check out, where you can check out all their merchandise on the Steelers, the Pirates, the Penguins, Pitt, anything Pittsburgh sports, they've got there at Yinz's in the Berg. And if you can't make it to the Strip District, that's fine. They have a website, yinzerspgh.com. Go to yinzerspgh.com right now, and you'll be able to check out all that merchandise that's updated weekly with new material. Go to yinzerspgh.com for Yinzers in the Berg for all your Pittsburgh sports apparel. We're back here in the North Shore Drive podcast here at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. I'm your host, Chris Carter. We're now joined by Andrew Destin, who was on hand for the Penguins' win over the San Jose Sharks. It was a little close until they got that empty netter from Jake Guentzel. But Jake Guentzel did get the goals. But you had a really interesting point, Andrew, about the guy who, it should come in no surprise, is driving the Penguins, but just how good Sidney Crosby has been, even while people haven't been talking him up that much this year.
Yeah, Sidney Crosby, especially over this stretch, basically since the All-Star break and a little bit before that, a stat that got thrown out by the Penguins themselves was that since January 16th, 17 points in 11 games, that's the second most points of any player in the NHL over that stretch. And, you know, you could say that's cherry-picking stats for a period of time to make a guy look good, but I mean, hey, close to a dozen games, that's a significant stint of time, and he's been tremendous during that stretch. And it hasn't necessarily been goals, and we saw that last night. I mean, the Penguins got three goals as a team. Crosby had assists on all three of them, albeit one of them was an empty netter, but he was, you know, a contributing factor in all of them. And for Penguins fans on the East Coast who stayed up for this one, personally, I don't know that I've seen a more beautiful assist than the one he dished off to Jake Guentzel for his first goal. A behind-the-back, no-look, backhanded pass from right behind the net. Aaron Dell, the San Jose Sharks goalie, had absolutely no idea where the puck was. And I don't know if anybody else on the Sharks side did either. And Jake Guentzel put it best. He said, you know, when he makes plays like that, it's easy for me. All I got to do is just put it in. And that just goes to show you the kind of player that Crosby is, has been, still is, and how important he still is for this Penguins team as they continue to kind of right the ship, eke out points when they need to, especially with Tristan Jarry out. I mean, to go 2-1 on this road trip, they took care of business against the teams they were supposed to. Didn't look great against the Kings in the maddening, inconsistent way that the Penguins have played all season long. But they got 4 points out of six, and Sidney Crosby has been as important as anybody in leading that charge.
And I think that inconsistency that you're talking about there, that's the big question that the Penguins have faced all season. Can Crosby's greatness, along with Malkin Letang, can those top guys that we've been talking about all year long, can they help minimize the points where the Penguins are inconsistent, especially from their back lines when they're having rough days? You know, we've been talking about the top six is what's going to carry the Penguins all season, and there's been plenty of games where they have. But clearly, you know, we've seen over the first half of the season, they can't always do it. They need help from below, from their lower lines. And, you know, I think now we're at a point where, you know, you get a win like this, it's great. You know, but you're supposed to beat the Sharks. You know, especially the way that the Sharks are this year. It was disappointing when they didn't beat the Sharks a little bit, a few weeks ago. So, for them to get this win, I think it's important. But it does kind of highlight, you know, when's the next time that we're going to be pointing to those last two lines and saying they came up short again.
Yeah, and absolutely. And it's also worth noting that, you know, with those bottom six, those third and fourth lines, that just when it looks like they're getting healthy and just when it looks like they're starting to, you know, maybe be able to make a run, put things going in the right direction, sure enough, right before puck drop, Ryan Poehling is a late scratch. And he's a guy who, unfortunate for him, the last month and a half, 2 months, has really been dealing with a nagging upper body injury that's constantly moving him in and out of the lineup. And he had finally been able to stick in it for the last few games. And sure enough, he gets pulled, you know, right before. And Drew O'Connor has to slide in for him. And that's no slight on Drew O'Connor to call him a slouch or anything like that. But Poehling is a high-energy guy who's great on the forecheck, who's been really important as a penalty killer and just as a guy on that fourth unit. So, the consistency just hasn't been there in terms of personnel, which, you know, knock on wood if you're the Penguins, has been the case for the top six. You know, I mean, for what it's worth, guys like Crosby and Malkin, they haven't missed games this year, and you can say it about the rest of the guys too. You know, Guentzel, I mean, Zucker, this is as healthy as he's been as a Penguin for as consistent or as available as those guys have all been, just hasn't been the case with the bottom six. And even in the win against San Jose, that proves to be the case again. And that's something that if you're Coach Mike Sullivan, you gotta be a little concerned about that, because that's a development that you thought you maybe had nipped in the bud with Poehling. And sure enough, it rises again. And that just shows where this Penguins team is in terms of its depth and how injuries continue to plague it in spots where they would really prefer it not to.
Certainly. You know, that's something that I think that we're going to keep talking about all year long when we look at things. But I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the goalie play, because Casey Smith looked like he had a really good game. 38 saves, 97.4 save percentage on the night. You know, up from a 90.7 you know, save percentage that he's had on the year. Only let up a single goal. And again, yes, the Sharks are bad, but you need these games from him when Tristan Jarry's out, and he's been out, and they've been trying to mitigate that situation. What was your thoughts on how Casey Smith played, and when do you think Tristan Jarry could be back for the Penguins if he comes back anytime soon?
Yeah, the first part about Casey Smith, for me, this was his most impressive game of the season. Because, yeah, this is a Sharks team that, you know, they're a bottom feeder in the Western Conference. They're a team in flux. It's rebuilding. But what they do is get a lot of pucks on net. They do score a lot of goals. Usually it just means that they'll end up losing the game 5-3 or 6-4 or something of that variety. They're usually going to get theirs, too. That was not the case against Casey DeSmith. Timo Meier, Logan Couture, all these guys, they had high-scoring chance opportunities, or, you know, high danger opportunities in front of the net. And really, it was just the last one that Meier was able to sneak by him. But other than that, Smith was on his game. He was active with his stick. You know, this was as good as he's looked, as confident as he looked. And Sullivan talked about it afterward. He was saying how, hey, I mean, you know, when he's confident like that, you know, it's a trickle down. You know, the rest of the team, it kind of embraces that. It's not lost on them. And I think, you know, the performance we saw from KC, that's really as good as he's looked all season long, and came at a huge time. Because, yeah, it is the Sharks. It's not one of the bellwether franchises of the Eastern Conference by any means. But these are wins that you have to have, regardless of who your goalie is, and especially when you don't have Tristan Jarry back there, who, in terms of a return timetable, to me, I was pointing toward this game as being a potential one for him to come back, but I guess just hadn't been cleared yet by the team's medical staff. He's inching closer. He's now taking part in a full practice on Monday in Los Angeles. He's taking part in pregame skates. Two of the skates during this three-game road trip. They didn't have one before the Kings game, but skated in Anaheim, skated in San Jose. And then in San Jose, that was for, I believe, over an hour. He was getting extra reps in with guys after, most of them had skated off the ice. So he's close timetable-wise. I was thinking for sure he'd be back for San Jose. Maybe we see him in New York, but could be holding off till Saturday in New Jersey. At this point, it really is, anybody's guess. But he's practicing. He's getting live reps. He's getting shots on him. It's really any day now. Not to use the term day-to-day, but he really is getting that close.
Well, he's started, I believe, he's been in net the last, seven games for the Penguins, going back to late January. I'm sure that they would welcome having their starting guy back, Jarry. He hasn't played since they lost in overtime to the Devils back on Sunday, January 22nd. Will he play Friday against the Islanders? We'll find out. But if you want to keep finding out, follow our guys Matt Benzel and Andrew Destin, who cover the Penguins for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us here in the North Shore Drive podcast. We'll keep you up to date with things, maybe even get you guys a pre-game look at the Friday matchup with our Friday episode of the North Shore Drive podcast. I'm your host, Chris Carter, here on the North Shore Drive podcast from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thank you to everyone who checked us out. Thank you to all our guests today. We'll be back Friday with another episode right here of the North Shore Drive podcast on the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's YouTube channel. We'll see you then. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the North Shore Drive podcast of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. If you're watching this video on YouTube, please like the video and subscribe to our YouTube channel. For 6 months of digital access to post-gazette.com for just $6, click the link down below in the description.
Llegaron los Propane Days a Lowe's. Desde ahora hasta el 16 de junio, los miembros MVPs de Lowe's reciben un 20% de reembolso en pintura con una tarjeta de regalo electrónica de Lowe's por compras de pinturas elegibles de $100 o más. Lleva la nueva y exclusiva pintura HGTV Home de Sherwin-Williams SpecRite para interiores. Lowe's sabe de pros. Aplican exclusiones, restricciones y más términos. Visita Lowe's.com/L/Pro Loyalty Terms. Sujeto a cambios.